This is episode 18 with Tothra Street and Michael Jackson.
Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue.
Aloha, and welcome to this episode of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. Today's co-guests are Michael Jackson and Tothra Street. Mike is a founding member of ShapingTomorrow.com, an AI-driven, web-based strategic forecasting portal for corporate innovation, market research, government policy, and risk management. He often speaks at conferences on a diversity of topics related to the future. I actually met Mike at a futures conference in Finland in 2018. Tothra is the founder of Tothra Street and Company. She is a leadership futurist and entrepreneur educator. She leverages faith in humanity to create new futures and new ways to empower leaders. She is a practical visionary who focuses on skills building for courageous leadership. In today's dialogue, we jump between the power of digital technology and the importance of human values. If you're interested in how to use horizon scanning as a GPS to the future, how to use values to thrive in complexity and change, how technology can help leadership gain insights about the future to increase decision-making confidence and reduce leadership stress, why leadership needs both real-time data and future vision to properly manage crisis, how to utilize both values and vision to promote and measure change, and why old styles of leadership is dying, and how that will foster a renewed leadership strength, then this episode is for you. Let's listen. Aloha, Tothra and Mike, really happy to have you on this episode today. And as always, I want to start with this key question of how can leadership be more intelligent about the future or futures given uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change in the world? And I'd love for you both to answer that from your perspective or your work. And I'd love to start with Mike.
Well, Tyler, in my perspective, I was frustrated as a chief executive that I couldn't see the future fast enough in the 1990s. But then I discovered that others before me had invented a process called horizon scanning or environmental scanning, and that there were many organizations in the world that practice this process. Basically, it's about them finding out what's going on in the world and using horizon scanning a bit like a GPS to tell them what's coming and to be able for them to mitigate risk and to highlight opportunities that they could seize faster than their rivals. So we are helping our clients find uncertainties, complexities, and helping them to exponentially change what they do. And the coronavirus for us was never a surprise. It's been going on for years. Bill Gates told the world that we were unprepared in 2015, and the world chose not to do much about it except for some very smart clients who watch those things and do exercises on them regularly.
Great. And Tothra, from your perspective, how do you answer this question of future intelligent leadership?
Well, it's a big question, and it's multifaceted. But where I come from, how I come at things around leadership in general is from the perspective of skill development and continual improvement. And you know, I've got my own sort of take on leadership as a leadership futurist and looking at it from the perspective of what future do we want to create. And where I go to with how we get there is basically looking at the skills and the capacities that we want to develop to enable this, you know, a different future. And so when I think of things like uncertainty, mindfulness and self-awareness come to mind. And I know that you've talked about self-awareness in the past and previous episodes. For me, it's about looking at an experience of stress, and especially right now, I think we're all pretty stressed and anxious, and especially, you know, very, very uncertain future at the moment. The capacities that I think are important to raise our self-awareness around how we deal with stress, certainly look at, you know, what are the things that stress us out? What are the things that we, you know, we encounter on a day-to-day basis that can impact our ability to make good decisions? And especially now when we've got this, you know, uncertainty at the level that we currently do, making good decisions is so, so important. And I think it's, you know, a lot of us are quite impacted by stress and maybe not making the best decisions. But, you know, when we can look at it from what we know about ourselves and anticipate that maybe this is what's going on at the moment, that there's a lot of opportunity there. And I also, one of the things that stands out for me around that also is this idea of acceptance and accepting things as they are, which is not always easy. I saw something recently that said, happiness is reality minus expectations. And that's something that I've been really interested in as far as not pursuing happiness, but just being aware of experiencing it is about letting go of expecting that we are going to know what's going to happen. And I think there's certainly a lot of predictors, like Mike says, you know, there's information that we can use to help us, you know, mitigate risk and seize opportunities, etc. For me, looking at, you know, we are in the situation that we're in, and there, you know, sure, there's things that we can do to make it better, but I think one of the things that's important for me is just accepting how it is and how it isn't. And when I think of complexity, I think of systems theory and Kruger's theory of human development and being able to see multiple perspectives. I think the more we can develop that skill, the more we can mature as a species to embrace complexity and to see all of the unintended consequences of the things that we have, the collective decisions that we have made without an awareness of the different considerations. I've got more to say, but I'll stop there for now.
Great. And Mike, following up with you, you're using a lot of technology for your foresight work. And I'm curious how that relates to this idea of wanting to create certain future, but also how there might be inertia around certain futures that's already building and how technology can help us see that.
Well, the start for me was back in 1995 when I presented my last corporate plan as a CEO to my chairman, and he and the board liked the plan. And I said, I thought it was not a good plan, even though I was pleased with his comment, because I couldn't see the future fast enough. And so most of the stress in the organization was caused by us not really having a plan that was robust enough to last 5 years in the old traditional way. And I told him I thought the plan would change the next morning, and I didn't understand how I could build a plan for the board that would endure across a 5-year time frame. I then got very lucky and got invited to listen to some futurists. And I realized that they all had various views on the future, and that these different systems thinking views were not in one place. So our system allows our clients to go in and ask a question about the future, and it will then come back and tell them what the world is saying, what social media and the web is saying about likely potential futures in the next 5, 10, 15 years, and give them the tools to think through what they ought to do. And obviously right now we're inundated with organizations wanting to know more about what might happen with the coronavirus, et cetera. And the machine is constantly tracking every day to see what changes are being made to society, politics, economics, and technology in order to overcome this aberration that happened 100 years ago and is happening again now.
And is it helping some of the clients, I guess, relieve some of that stress too then, because they're able to have something, they can get some data and information, whereas a lot of places it's just not available.
Yes. Yeah. If I were in this situation now as a CEO, I know things would have moved on, but I would be as Tathra said, and I would be, I wouldn't be panicking because I've always tried to say, keep calm and carry on. Mm-hmm. But I'd still be stressed inside my body in terms of thinking about what am I going to do? How am I going to keep my people together? Mm-hmm. How am I going to continue building the business? And so that stress is internal, never shown to the rest of the organization, maybe to the chairman, but not to anybody else. But with a tool like the one we're using, I get more confident that I know what's going to happen or is likely to happen, and I can plan better for the future. It's a GPS at the end of the day, making sure that I'm on the right road or the best road possible, and making changes as I see changes happening.
And Tathra, do you have a follow-up for that?
I'm actually interested to ask Mike a question about something that I've been thinking about for quite some time. And, you know, I think we all adapt as best we can, but I wonder if you have thoughts on, you know, given a big part of doing business is about, you know, strategy and planning and goal setting, et cetera. What advice do you have around creating goals and strategies, et cetera, that are adaptable, that, you know, because, you know, obviously the world has changed a lot in a very short period of time, and what we knew about how the world was a few months ago is now no longer true. So, you know, what advice do you have around goals and plans to adapt to change? Like when things change, how do you respond?
Well, I can relate to several times that has happened to me in my life. And basically when that has happened, my first reaction is not, as I said, to keep calm and carry on, but not to try and make decisions on my own. And to use every available piece of intelligence, mm-hmm. especially from my executive and people around me, as to what they think should happen. I'm a great believer in distributing decision making, and not everybody expecting me to make the wonderful decision that says that we need to go this way, folks. So when the exchange rate mechanism collapsed in, I think it was 1992, and the mortgage rate went from about 3% to 15% in 4 hours. I did exactly that. And I sat with the team and said, look, we're going to come through this, but we've got to work out together how we're going to do it. And one of those processes was to horizon scan what's going on, to try and get some sense of what others were doing, and then to work out our own plan. But at the end of the day, the vision we had for the company stood the test of time through that. We'd already built our vision and our values, and we knew where we wanted to go. We just had to deal with a short-term crisis, and recognize that we needed to look after our customers and our staff in that process as much as we did to look after our vision.
So, but how does it work for you with goals and strategies? Like, do you, given, you know, think, especially in the last little while, things have changed a lot. So do you just simply reassess and make new goals and strategies, or how do you?
Yeah, that's what I would do. I'd reassess the goals, reassess the strategies, reassess any objectives and say, look, we can't afford to do that one right now, but we must do this one. We'll do that one differently. We'll reprioritize, et cetera. But I've never been a great one for large documents that have thousands of goals and objectives in. Very short, simple, so that people can understand. And I'd share that with my entire staff. And have thousands of people, and I would let them all know what was going on and what we all thought, and involve them as well. So I'm a great believer in surveying the staff and saying, what do you think should happen? And that's then led me over the years to then say, why just the staff? Why not all the stakeholders? Let's survey the stakeholders, find out what we think we should be doing, because you get much better information that way. You're not sitting there just making a decision and everybody else says, oh, that's terrible. And you thought you were making the right decision, but everybody else thought no. Yeah.
Sounds like you're really harnessing the collective intelligence and recognizing the strength and the diversity of the views and perspectives that exist, not just within your staff, but your whole community.
Yes, and because our system is real time, our system is almost real time. It's 24 hours behind, and the surveys can be done in a couple of days. You're always up to date. You can run the survey whenever you want. You can scan the horizon whenever you want. Let's say particular future. What is the future of leadership? The machine will tell you. It'll tell you what everybody's thinking about, where leadership is going. or it might tell you what the future of intelligence is. It'll tell you yesterday what people were saying about the future of intelligence and where it might go. So this reduces stress. It reduces stress. And I find it surprising how many organizations are looking through the rearview mirror to steer their companies and not looking ahead. And even in a time of crisis, I'll give you one other example. In one particular organization, I got the team to realize that we were in the middle of a crisis. But I also presented to them the fact that trying to understand the crisis was half the battle. The other half was knowing what we were going to do after the crisis. And after a few hours of discussion, they gave up 2 days a week, 2 days every 2 weeks, to concentrate on the future, while the rest of the time was spent fighting the two major fires we had in the business. And I still find it amazing that so many businesses will concentrate on cutting cost and reducing staffing in a crisis, and not looking at the opportunities that come out of a crisis while everyone else is losing their head. So I one of the things that might come out of this is the idea that even in a crisis, leaders should be thinking about the future and trying to figure out what's going to be like after the crisis and how they get there, not dealing with the crisis and then finding that they're out of business because they stop worrying about what their business would look like afterwards.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting also to think about how, you know, especially when we go into this high stress state, we move into like a sympathetic mode in our brain, and really we get really focused on threats and fears. And it's like part of the job of a leader is really to get people out of that state so they can start thinking about the future.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Tathra, with your work, do you have like tips on how to do that, how to move people from that stress state of really going and focusing on the moment into future thinking?
Well, I think the vision obviously is an important communication tool. And one of the things that we're seeing in leaders in the world at the moment is around, you know, frequent communication, communicating in a way that invites people to follow social distancing rules, etc. It's been quite a fascinating experience being here in Australia and watching people's response to Jacinda Ardern, who leads one of our nearest neighbors in New Zealand, and comparing her approach to the approach of the Australian Prime Minister. And there's a lot of let's call it fandom really admiring her approach, and what we can see there is that she's communicating often, she's communicating in a way that's calm and pleasant. She doesn't have that sort of fear mongering in any way, shape or form. And one of the things that there was a bit of a contrasting sentiment that was raised by one of our local comedians here in Australia in reference to how our Prime Minister was communicating how we should follow the rules. And she said, you know, if you speak to us like petulant children, we will behave like petulant children. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's kind of this old school kind of almost parental role of, you know, you better do the right thing, or, you know, there will be consequences and we will fine you. And whereas in New Zealand, it's much more speaking to the adult. So the communication is about, you know, we know that you are going to have a rough time, but we want to engage in this in a way that is going to create the best possible result. Like, it really speaks to that maturity rather than speaking to the immaturity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the leadership traits that enables, you know, people to feel calm, to feel like, oh, yes, I do want to follow that leader. Mm-hmm. And provides less resistance, which is, you know, one of the reasons why New Zealand's infection rate has been so low is that they, you know, they have a leader who is leading effectively. Whereas in Australia, you know, we're doing pretty good. But it's the way that our Prime Minister has been communicating has been under fire a fair bit, put it that way. And, you know, we've got an app that is modeled after what happened in Singapore, and there was you know, an expectation that, you know, if 40% of people downloaded the app, then that would be, you know, enable us to relax the laws. And it didn't quite get there. They had, you know, a fair bit of support early on, but it didn't, it certainly didn't get to 40%, but they're relaxing the restrictions at this point anyways. But, you know, I guess they're in some ways kind of following that, adapting to the environment as in the moment as much as possible as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting.
She would be one of my role models.
Yeah. Right, I think a lot of people are looking at her as a role model at the moment.
And I think that one of the things that I've done almost throughout my life, which is a long while now, is always to be following role models, actively watching what they do, watching what they don't do, trying to emulate them, and also watching non-role models, because you can learn a lot from people that you sit there and think, I wouldn't do it that way if I were you, and trying to eliminate those. Those characteristics out of your own leadership style is hard, but it can be practiced and learnt.
And that's the key.
I really recommend using that process of looking at role models and non-role models to improve your leadership style.
And I think even this idea that, you know, leadership skills and many of the skills that we thought in the past were innate, it's now very clear that we can learn these things. I think it's still something that's taken for granted, and especially, you know, in a state where people are, you know, they're stressed, they're looking for the threat, they're in that, you know, kind of fight or flight. It's hard to you know, kind of slow down and recognize that, right, I can make a choice here. I can learn from what I'm experiencing. But quite often we don't learn it. We're not taught to, you know, to reflect. Very, very rarely is reflection and time to look at, okay, well, this didn't work. What can I learn from that? How can I do something differently? I mean, it sounds really logical. And you know, on some level, we do a fair bit of that. But I think there's a really big opportunity for, especially from the perspective of, you know, what future do we want to create? Yes, we have the past to learn from. Mm-hmm. But there's also, you know, what is emerging on the future, what is around the corner, as you know, Mike's been telling us about as well, that to integrate, you know, both of what we learned from the past and what we can foresee is coming, and to be in that space of, okay, well, here's the situation, what is the best choice that I can make, and to come from that place.
That's a good question. That's a good question. I would have used that in 1992 or something similar. We're in this situation. How do we work? Well, how do we work our way out of this, guys? What are we going to do? And as a leader, I've tried not to tell them the answer. In fact, I remember several times people telling my successor that I had a different management style. And the management style was to pose a question and then stand back and let them answer the question and help them come to a conclusion. But only when they come to a conclusion they all agreed with would I then back the process and say, I'm with you. But that's a very different management style from the one we all grew up in, where the boss had all the decision making in his hands and the people there did what they were told.
And I think that's one of the things that's really apparent at the moment. We can, in a crisis, we can see where the kind of old school approaches that are very directive, and look, there's, in a crisis, it being directive is appropriate, but again, there's that real distinction between being directive in a way that inspires people to take action from a place of care, and people who are giving direction in a way that just has people following instructions, or at least trying to make them follow instructions, which these days, you know, with the, you know, internet being, I guess, you know, creating a space of greater transparency, there is authority doesn't have the same kind of sway that it has in the past, and that there's a greater need for leaders to earn trust rather than assume that it is just given simply out of position.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think that's great points you're bringing up, and I'm curious what you both think about, I guess, going back to the Prime Minister of New Zealand. It seems like she had a very clear goal in mind. You know, she wanted to get to a certain future where it was maybe no coronavirus, right?
versus maybe the response we're seeing in leadership in, say, the U.S., where it's not clear exactly what their end goal is. You know, so even in this crisis, it seems like she had an end goal, the prime minister in New Zealand, and she drove towards that and got there, versus not having a goal. How can leadership, I guess, handle these types of complex situations where it's not always easy to know what to do?
Well, I think it's actually more about values and less about goals. I think the values that Jacinda Ardern expresses are about championing the well-being of her people. I mean, her you know, national budget was a well-being budget, and she, you know, defended that and was lauded for that. And so I think that's what guides her. So it's not, you know, we're going to kill this virus. It's more, you know, the well-being of my people is the most important thing. Whereas in the U.S., it's that's not the greatest value. And I think, you know, it's creating a really divisive situation where the values of what, you know, once was considered to be the greatest nation in the world, that it's really breaking down, and you know, seeing how many people are left behind and the disproportionate infections in people of color and people of, you know, lower socioeconomic status and, you know, access to care, I think is going to really test the values, and very likely something new will emerge. And so to see, you know, that a very small country like New Zealand doing what it does on a foundation of the well-being of its people is a real inspiration for us to draw from, and to aspire to create a future that might be more about, you know, widespread well-being rather than the situation that there is at the moment.
Do you have any follow-up for that, Mike?
Yeah, I absolutely. I did an exercise long while ago when I was a CEO with an organization that asked me to attend a meeting with 15 other entrepreneurial big change organizations that have gone through this type of process. Mm. And we were all asked to present our models of how we'd managed to get from zero to being one of the best companies. And what was interesting about it was everybody had a different shape to describe this thing, whether it was a square or a diamond or a circle or whatever. But they all had the same, basic processes. And I go a bit further back from where Tathra was. They'd all got a vision of what they wanted to achieve, and they got an agreement about the vision, as we had. They all had defined their cultural values, which is where Tathra came in, and they knew what their cultural values were. So when a crisis hit, they could immediately say, this is not in line with our vision. How do we get back on our vision? How do we stick with our culture regardless of what's going on? In my case, it was always customers first. And so we would always start with the customer, not with ourselves. And then there were three other pieces. One was measures. How are we going to measure whether we're achieving our vision and culture? What processes are we going to use for doing that? And one Tathra has already mentioned, communication. And absolute constant communication to the various stakeholders, so they never felt left out, left behind, and they could do their job without having to keep referring to us to ask questions. Yeah. The only piece that I'd add to that since then is that at that time I wasn't involved in horizon scanning. And we did a pretty crude job of understanding what was happening in the world from the executives just thinking it up in their heads. And so I'd add 161 now, which is that before you can have a direction, you've got to know where the possibilities and opportunities are and the risks of taking a particular pathway. But basically, that model still stands for me, and I see many organizations I work with operating that model.
That's great. I love how you both brought it to the values as a key, especially in crisis or in complexity. And I'm curious, you know, if do you think that this is going to become more important in the future now, or even now, and continue on into the future for leadership?
Well, I think it's one of the things that underpins everything. You know, we can have our goals and our vision, and those may change, but I think our values are what endures. But having said that, I think there is a shift in values globally. And I think this, you know, the coronavirus is a real test of that. And you know, I think there's also a real shift between, well, maybe it's more worldviews than values, and from a, you know, like an individualist worldview where it's me first, and, you know, I'm going to take care of my family and I'm going to, you know, buy toilet paper so no one else can, or a more collectivist worldview where we're acting from a place of care, where we're looking at the health of our community as what is going to be an indicator of our own health, and helping others as a way to help ourselves. So yeah, it's an interesting one. I think it's values is enduring, and I think it's going to come to the surface more. You know, it's, I guess it's one of those things that's really, you know, tried and true, but I think we're going to be able to see it in a different light, having been, you know, tested at this particular juncture in history. And, you know, hindsight will, well, as they say, hindsight's 2020. So we'll certainly see that maybe once 2020 is over.
I think there's two comments I'd make. One is that the old school is dying out.
Absolutely.
And new managers are taking their place with a completely different view of the world, thank God. And that will change values. We'll go away from directorial type decision making to more collaborative decision making. And we know that there's huge amounts of technology out there now that helps people collaborate wherever they are, whether they're in the office or at home. But the second point would be about the whole issue of values and people's change in an environment where the coronavirus is around. When we have these types of great recessions, coronaviruses, etc., it's usually the weakest organizations that go to the wall, the ones who haven't got the values, the ones who haven't got a vision, the ones who haven't planned ahead, etc., etc. And this, at the end of the day, is a bit like a forest being knocked down during a typhoon or a hurricane. First of all, there's panic because the forest has been destroyed, but the forest regenerates itself, and what's been knocked down comes back even stronger in a different way. So I personally think the coronavirus is, while it's terrible about what's happening right now, it's an opportunity to do things differently and sweep away stuff that doesn't need to be there. So I'm more opportunistic than I am pessimistic about the virus. It won't be defeated. It'll probably never be defeated. But it can be controlled, and it will take time to do that. But after that, I think we'll find some really new ways of working with each other and living with each other and traveling, et cetera, which somebody said to me a few weeks ago. They said, most of the technology we need to do this is already here. Mm-hmm. It's just not reached us yet. Mm-hmm. And you see some of that already arriving.
Yeah, and that's precisely the opportunity that's before us, is that we can see that how things have, you know, in like, there's really no going back to normal. Like, normal really wasn't working. And now that we can see that, yeah, yes, we can work from home, and yes, we can, you know, reduce our global emissions and things like that. There is a greater opportunity for us to not just to shift the values. And, you know, in many ways, If we're not careful, we will go back to normal. We will go back to what wasn't working. But we do have this beautiful opportunity before us. And so when we look at shifting our values, like, it's not really the kind of thing that happens by default. It happens by people who are committed, speaking up, and using their influence skillfully to really shift those values. And I think as we're starting to see that some of the values that we've held are actually quite destructive, and that there is a possibility of holding a set of values that is more, like you say, regenerative. To me, that's where the greatest opportunity is, and that where we can recognize where we can influence and how we can do that with great skill and inspiration and empowerment. Those are the things that I'm quite excited by and interested to see, kind of, you know, how it all pans out, but also with an aim to part of my work is about, you know, creating, changing the face of leadership, and doing that through skill development, capacity building, and recognizing that we do have a choice about how it goes, and we can create a future that we want to live into, and that we can learn what it takes to do that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I tend to think of it as this is an opportunity to free up a lot of energy and resources that were tied up in old systems, right? And old exactly. mindsets and old mindsets as well. And I think, you know, if we get leadership who doesn't have that foresight, but is looking, I guess, back into the past to try to recreate that again, they're not going to be able to take advantage of this shift. And I think like Mike is saying, they're not going to weather this very well.
We get the leaders that we deserve. And when we come from a place of fear and we succumb to fear that is, you know, where political campaigns are fear-based, like in Australia, we were very surprised that we, you know, the current prime minister was reelected, but it was quite a very deliberate and strategic fear-based campaign that enabled that. So I think, you know, here we have this choice again. We can come from, you know, fear of ill health, fear of, you know, overwhelming the healthcare system, or we can come from, how do we create well-being? How do we generate health and you know, dealing with this virus in the most powerful way that we can? And so again, I feel like this is the choice that we have, is that we can continue to be fear-based and inadvertently cause you know, destructive unintended outcomes, or we can make a choice for a future that we want, a future that is regenerative, is about you know, recognizing what wasn't working and creating something different and creating something that helps us thrive rather than just survive.
But we must also look at the unintended outcomes, because
absolutely,
if we don't do that, we are myopic, and we're not recognizing that it's not all going to be rosy. It might be bad.
Yes.
And therefore, we need a strategy for that as well. So, I think the interesting thing about Asia, I can't speak for Australia, but I think it's really interesting to look at the number of cases in Asia and the number of deaths in Asia, which is far lower than Europe and the USA, and that's because the SARS crisis of maybe 10, 15 years ago completely changed people's views about pandemics in Asia. And so immediately this pandemic, which was never a pandemic at the beginning, but we all knew it probably would be, caused all the businesses to start putting temperature checks in the business well before the pandemic was created, and signing forms to say where you'd been, and checking yourself out of the airport. This was so much faster in Asia than it was in Europe and America. Mm-hmm. And that's because they learned from the last one. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that Europe and Asia hopefully will learn from this one, and we won't see something as bad as this again, because we'll have got our act together when we sit down and think about what is it we should be doing in order not to make this happen again.
Yeah, it's as you said, it gives me the image of leadership that really empowers their people to take these actions on their own, right?
Because
in Japan, so similar things happened where people started to take actions on their own before government gave advice. But somewhere in like America, for example, where they haven't had this type of experience before, and they have very kind of centralized leadership in many ways, or they expect kind of that. There wasn't much action. No one knew what to do, and no one really was empowered to do much. So it's very interesting.
Unless it's changed much, I don't think the media, well, I used to live there, and I was appalled at the level of media coverage of things like this. It would be at the bottom of the TV headlines and not at the top.
So
it goes back to what Tatra said before, communication. And there's a lot of communication here, but maybe people don't like being locked down, but it's working.
Curious, Mike, from your perspectives, just in general, you know, the technology you're using, are you able to see some trends that are positive versus negative?
There are certainly a lot of organizations who are making money out of this coronavirus problem because they're in the right place at the right time. And there are others that aren't and are losing money hand over fist. I have a peculiar view on this. I, I sit there and I watch all of these aerospace companies wanting to go to the government, wanting money. What were they doing for the last 30 years? The pandemics have been around for over 100 years. They've been regularly telegraphed, as I said earlier. And we're back into the process of the Great Recession, where the bank said, it's not our fault, bail us out. Well, I was a banker, and it was the banker's fault. And I knew many of the bankers that led us over the cliff. I'm not convinced we should bail any of them out and let them die. I know that's bad for the world, but that's a crazy view on my part. I just think it's not nonsense to have organizations pretend that they didn't know and didn't spend money on the things they should have spent. I think that might change as part of this process. Governments will say, we can't afford to keep bailing out organizations that are not thinking about the future.
Well, and it's not even about whether they can afford it. It's a choice that they're making to enforce taking responsibility. And I wonder if that's a value that may shift from, you know, I mean, at this stage of our... Go ahead.
After the government, the governments are going to sit there and say, we can't afford to keep bailing out people when they don't when they don't take precautions. That's my point. I agree with you. But if the government's sitting there saying, I'm going to run out of money every 3 years because we've got another crisis caused by different sectors, they're going to sit there and say, we have to have a different system. My hope is that they will do that. So to answer your question a different way, I think that there are a lot of organizations working on different ways to help people. Google and Apple are working on this device and contact tracing. And there are a lot of technology companies working on different devices to help people be safe when they go out. And new ways of retailers protecting their staff, such as screens. So being in a screen company is probably good at the moment in terms of providing glass screens, et cetera, et cetera. So there's lots of opportunities out there. There's always as many opportunities in a crisis as there are risks.
And I suspect that there's going to be a lot of new businesses, you know, as people are at home, you know, they don't have the same kind of stimulation to sort of distract them from the ideas that they might have. I suspect there's going to be a lot of new entrepreneurs, new businesses, new, you know, people seeing things that frustrate them and questioning why it needs to be that way and actually coming up with ideas. But I just wanted to finish what I was saying before about personal responsibility. One of the things that we're seeing at the moment is that the choices of an individual can have a huge impact. And we're seeing that now in a way that we haven't in the past. Before, we kind of had this thought, I'm just one person, I can't make a difference. But now we're seeing that, you know, one person can infect, you know, hundreds of others. And so I'm curious about this idea of taking personal responsibility as an increase or as a value that we may take up that may also be not just spread into, but called for from perhaps even customers to the business community, saying, we really want you to take responsibility. We're going to support businesses that take responsibility, and we're not going to support businesses that don't. So that's something that I'd really like to see. That's the future I'd like to create as well.
I don't think we'll see that in the Philippines anytime soon, because despite the lockdown, still lots of people want to break the rules.
There's a lot of that here too.
Objecting to what the government, but in the UK, I think there's a really good chance of that. And that the amount of people that have been locking themselves down, self-volunteering to do that and helping each other is part of the British spirit. But I think that I think that this is something that we will see more of in the UK and possibly in other countries.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I think that plays a lot into leadership too, because when you have, you know, a team of people, an organization or a country that with people that have a lot more self-responsibility, there's a different way to lead them, I think. And again, like going back, you can empower them more and they will take action on that. And you need less of the command and control kind of mentality.
Yeah, and it's along the lines of, you know, before Mike was talking about distributed decision making, if we look at the idea of distributed leadership and recognizing that personal responsibility is actually self-leadership, and that we all, you know, my strong belief is that we all have leadership capacity. And when we have leaders who encourage us to take responsibility, to be that, you know, those self-motivating leaders that inspire others, and to do that in a way that uses, like I said, that skillful influence to inspire people to take action from a place of care, that's when we'll start to see some real shifts. But it's not going to happen on its own. It really needs to happen because people decide that that's what they want, mm-hmm. and that that's the future that they want.
Do you not think that do you not think that if the political leaders don't do what you just said, Tathra, that new political leaders will arrive on the scene with a completely different view that's much more in line with the public, and that's probably how change will happen?
I think that's one of the ways that change will happen, but from what I've seen, the political realm is the last to change. And that it like So my background is in environmental activism, and I really thought that, you know, chaining myself to things and yelling things into a megaphone was going to be the things that changed. And, you know, as we know, that was a very naive view, and I really, you know, I got a headache banging my head against a wall and started to really question everything, question my own motivation, question my own tactics. And you know, in over the years, what I've seen is that where I believe one of the greatest areas of opportunity for shifting leadership is in business. And that's one of the reasons I love working with entrepreneurs, is because there's this, you know, desire to have an impact on the world and a desire to skill oneself up to do the things that it takes to enact a vision. And so I really think, you know, I mean, we're already starting to see things like, you know, the buy one, give one movement, the B Corp movement, you know, triple bottom line, designing for, you know, zero waste, etc. Like that stuff is already starting to happen. And I think it's really starting to gain momentum. And I think we'll see more and more of that. And, you know, purpose-based businesses that really want to use business as a force for good, I think is something that we'll see more and more as well.
I just think back to Brexit and to the EU and all the problems that are going on in France and Italy, et cetera, with the leaders there, and some mm-hmm. of them on the side of let's get out and some of them on the side of let's defend. And the public is beginning to vote those leaders out, the one who won't change, and sees the underlying causes better than the politicians themselves. I'm not so sure that we won't see some political change on a big scale.
I welcome large-scale political change. It's certainly something I've been sort of hungering for my entire life. But I think there's
I've not been chaining myself to a fence. I never did that. But I've been exercising my vote for somebody. But exercising my vote on the person that's going to give me my values is what I'm going to do.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think part of the challenge around that is that many of the democracies in the world have systems that are imperfect, if not broken. And so you can, you know, exercise your vote and, you know, your democratic right and to go to the ballot box, but that doesn't always generate the change, even of the mass of the people. And we've seen that in the US as well, like when you look at the numbers. And so I think political reform is going to also be a big driver. But yes, I agree. I absolutely welcome political change, and I really hope that that comes as well. But I think it'll come from a whole range of different areas. And I think business is one, politics is another. You know, maybe there'll be more that we don't know about yet.
Mm. Yep.
Well, let's wrap up here because the time is up. And how I'd like to end is just to ask you both to leave one word that you would like to kind of leave with a more future intelligent leader, or leave them in a sense. So what's one word that you would like to leave? Start with you, Tathra.
Inspiration.
And Mike?
Anticipate.
Well, thank you both for your time, your insights, and your wisdom.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more Futures Intelligent Leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about, so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.